readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm just back from a writer's conference on Cape Cod. I met and spoke with so many interesting folks, including an extremely successful screenwriter. That's a category we haven't explored together until today. We'll delve into screenwriting, plus preview books about the film industry, the people who've shaped American film, and novels that have become award-winning films. Speaking about the Academy Awards for a moment, in doing some research, I uncovered some really interesting stuff. As you know, the first Academy Awards were for films from 1927-1928. That year, there were two writing categories, Best Writing Adaptation and Best Original Story. Over the years, the screenwriting category grew and shrunk and grew again. There was even a short-lived category for Best Title Writing, discontinued at the end of the silent era. In 1935, the term screenplay was first used, and in 1957, the Modern Award was implemented, which are writing, adapted screenplay, awarded to the writer of a screenplay adapted from another source, usually a novel or play, and writing, original screenplay, awarded to the writer of a script not based on previously published material. So, who were the most successful screenwriters? Billy Wilder had 12 nominations and 3 wins, for The Lost Weekend in 1945, Sunset Boulevard in 1950, and The Apartment in 1960. Wilder shares the Academy Award record for Oscar writing wins with Francis Ford Coppola, Charles Brackett, and Paddy Chayefsky. Coppola took the award for Patton, 1970, The Godfather, 1972, and Godfather Part II, 1974. Charles Brackett took Oscar home for The Lost Weekend in 1945, Sunset Boulevard in 1950, and Titanic 1953. Chayefsky won for Marty in 1955, The Hospital in 1971, and Network in 1976. Other notable winners include Woody Allen with 14 nominations and 2 wins for Annie Hall in 1977 and Hannah and Her Sisters in 1986. John Huston had 8 nominations and 1 win for The Treasure of the Sierra Madre in 1948. And here are some stellar losers. Federico Fellini with 8 nominations and no wins, and Ingmar Bergman with 5 nominations and no wins. As you can see, the category is rich and fascinating, and who doesn't love the movies? Let's get to it as we turn to page 1 of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
No Country for Old Men won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay in 2007. Joel and Ethan Coen were the screenwriters. As you know, the book was written by Cormac McCarthy, best-selling author and National Book Award winner for All the Pretty Horses. No Country for Old Men is a mesmerizing modern-day Western. Llewellyn Moss is hunting antelope near the Texas-Mexico border when he stumbles upon several dead men, a stash of heroin, and more than $2 million in cash. When he takes off with the money, the hunter becomes the hunted. A drug cartel hires a former Special Forces agent to track down the loot, and a ruthless killer joins the chase. Also looking for Moss is Sheriff Bell, a World War II veteran who may be Moss's only hope for survival. and it is Sheriff Bell who makes the book a meditation on the battle between good and evil and the roles chance and choice play in the shaping of a life. Tom Stetschulte narrates.
The deputy left Chigurh standing in the corner of the office with his hands cuffed behind him while he sat in the swivel chair and took off his hat and put his feet up and called Lamar on the mobile.
Just walked in the door. Sheriff, he had some sort of thing on him, like one of them oxygen tanks for emphysema or whatever. Then he had a hose that run down the inside of his sleeve and went to one of them stun guns like they used at the slaughterhouse. Yes, sir. Well, that's what it looks like. You can see it when you get in. Yes, sir. I got it covered. Yes, sir.
When he stood up out of the chair, he swung the keys off his belt and opened the locked desk drawer to get the keys to the jail. He was slightly bent over when Chigurh squatted and scooted his manacled hands beneath him to the back of his knees. In the same motion, he sat and rocked backward and passed the chain under his feet and then stood instantly and effortlessly. If it looked like a thing he'd practiced many times, it was. He dropped his cuffed hands over the deputy's head and leaped into the air and slammed both knees against the back of the deputy's neck and hauled back on the chain. They went to the floor. The deputy was trying to get his hands inside the chain, but he couldn't. Chigurh lay there, pulling back on the bracelets with his knees between his arms and his face averted. The deputy was flailing wildly, and he began to walk sideways over the floor in a circle, kicking over the wastebasket, kicking the chair across the room. He kicked shut the door, and he wrapped the throw rug in a wad about them. He was gurgling and bleeding from the mouth. He was strangling on his own blood. Chigurh only hauled the harder. The nickel-plated cuffs bit to the bone. The deputy's right carotid artery burst, and a jet of blood shot across the room and hit the wall and ran down it. The deputy's legs slowed and then stopped. He lay jerking. Then he stopped moving altogether. Chigurh lay breathing quietly, holding him. When he got up, he took the keys from the deputy's belt and released himself and put the deputy's revolver in the waistband of his trousers and went into the bathroom. He ran cold water over his wrists until they stopped bleeding, and he tore strips from a hand towel with his teeth and wrapped his wrists and went back into the office. He sat on the desk and fastened the toweling with tape from a dispenser, studying the dead man gaping up from the floor. When he was done, he got the deputy's wallet out of his pocket and took the money and put it in the pocket of his shirt and dropped the wallet to the floor. Then he picked up his air tank and the stun gun and walked out the door and got into the deputy's car and started the engine and backed around and pulled out and headed up the road. On the interstate, he picked out a late-model Ford sedan with a single driver and turned on the lights and hit the siren briefly. The car pulled onto the shoulder. Chigurh pulled in behind him and shut off the engine and slung the tank across his shoulder and stepped out. The man was watching him in the rearview mirror as he walked up.
What's the problem, officer?
He said.
Sir, would you mind stepping out of the vehicle?
The man opened the door and stepped out.
What's this about? He said.
Would you step away from the vehicle, please?
The man stepped away from the vehicle. Chigurh could see the doubt come into his eyes at this blood-stained figure before him, but it came too late. He placed his hand on the man's head like a faith healer. The pneumatic hiss and click of the plunger sounded like a door closing. The man slid soundlessly to the ground, a round hole in his forehead from which the blood bubbled and ran down into his eyes, carrying with it his slowly uncoupling world visible to see. Chigurh wiped his hand with his handkerchief.
I just didn't want you to get blood on the car, he said.
Diane Lake has been a working screenwriter since 1993, when she sold her first story idea. Since then, she has been commissioned to write films for Columbia, Disney, Miramax, and Paramount. In addition, she's written a miniseries for NBC and created a half-hour series for CBS. Diane has also written work for numerous independent producers, like actors. Dustin Hoffman, for one. Diane's film Frida opened the Venice Film Festival in 2002 and was named one of the 10 best films of the year by numerous top 10 lists, including the National Board of Review and the American Film Institute. Frida was also nominated for 6 Academy Awards in 2003. Diane is a screenwriting professor now at Emerson College. Welcome, Diane. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, when you discovered you were a writer, how did you choose screenwriting over conventional fiction?
I always loved movies. As a kid, I loved going to the movie house on Saturday morning, and whatever was playing, I pretty much didn't care. I just loved it. And I think movies are the art form of our time. If Charles Dickens was alive today, he'd be writing movies.
All right. What was your training for screenwriting?
I had no training for screenwriting. I went to L.A. in 1990 and just thought, I think I want to try to write. I had a master's, but it was in 18th century rhetorical theory, which has, of course, nothing to do with the real world or screenwriting at all. So I just had this thought that I wanted to try to write, and I wanted to try to write movies, and they were in L.A., so I just went.
And how did you start knocking on doors?
At first, I started trying to write the great screenplay, which meant to me I bought screenplays. You can buy them out there. And I bought them, and I read them to look and see how people did it. And I think like any other kind of writing, you read what you would like to write. And if you read good stuff, maybe you have a shot of creating good stuff. So that's pretty much how I went about it.
Can you share some top tips about how to break into the field and how to pursue a very successful career?
Right. It's a really tough field to break into. I often tell people, you have a better shot of winning the lottery than selling a screenplay, which is sad but true. There's no career path. There's no follow these 10 steps and, you know, you'll get in the front door. So you have to make your own steps. And a big part of that often means being out in Los Angeles, because scripts get read based on who knows who and so forth. And unless you're there to make those connections, you might not get over the first hurdles. So you kind of have to be willing to fly by the seat of your pants and do that. Another way, though, if you absolutely can't be in LA, is to enter contests. There are some contests that agents troll for new clients. And by entering contests, your work can get seen and passed on to so-and-so, and then maybe you have a shot.
What do you think of fiction writers who actually do their own screenwriting?
You know, there aren't too many. It's often the other way around. Oftentimes, a writer is particularly good at screenwriting and not very good at fiction, and vice versa. I think if someone can do both, that's great. One of the reasons the studios don't usually want authors to write their own screenplays is because they're too close to the original material. 500-page novel has to be a 110-page screenplay. It's real hard for an author who's so close to that to cut it down to a manageable format for that film.
What control, if any, does a screenwriter have over the, you know, the process, or I won't even say the final product, but the process?
You don't have a lot of control. It's a collaborative art, making a film. The first step is the screenplay. I mean, you have control as you're writing, but your control disappears the minute you go into a room with other people who have read your work and want to give you advice on how to rewrite it. They have all kinds of reasons for wanting these changes, and some of them may not, you know, coincide with your reasons as the creator and the author and the person who cares about this story, but they have what they think are good business reasons. And if you don't make the changes, they will hire another writer to do so. So you have to learn to let your love of your own writing go. You have to learn to be collaborative and take advice and try it somebody else's way rather than yours.
Are there a group of screenwriters who you admire? I mean, certainly the general public isn't very familiar with, you know, the best screenwriters.
Yeah. Name a screenwriter.
Exactly.
I challenge any person in America pretty much to name a screenwriter. Right. They're just not the stars. Mm-hmm. The person sitting alone in a room, pounding out this creative idea, bringing to life these people that you end up loving on the screen, that person is someone you will never meet and never know. And we think, oh, the director, what a wonderful film he made. Well, how good a film could it have been without a great script? But nobody, it's boring. You can make a film on how XYZ movie was made, and you can go with your film crew to the set, and you can watch the director directing and saying, you do this and you do that. Who's going to want to take a film of a writer alone in a room with his laptop? You know, it's not going to happen. We don't have a glamorous profession, but we're the ones that create the words and the pictures that everybody else's jobs depend on. So in some respects, we're it, you know, we are it, and we get to enjoy that process, but it is a process you enjoy alone. And, you know, it's not something that's that exciting or glamorous. So yeah, nobody's going to know us, but you know what? That's okay. I don't necessarily want to be known as a screenwriter. I was saying to somebody earlier today, when I get on a plane anymore, I never say I'm a screenwriter. I usually say I'm a librarian, because then they'll leave me alone to read my book. If I say I'm a screenwriter, they have a story that would make a great movie, you know, and that ends up ruining my plane ride.
Is there a great difference between a playwright and a screenwriter?
Yeah, in a theater, a playwright is king. You do not touch a word of a playwright's dialogue without going to the playwright and saying, is it okay if we make this change? That's sort of laughable for a screenwriter. They'll change your dialogue, your you know narrative, anything, you know, if they think it'll help the story move forward. So, you know, the playwright is really God. And in terms of writing in general, playwright is at the top. They have most control. Then the novelist, then definitely down there somewhere is a screenwriter. Yeah.
What about writing for TV, the small screen versus the big screen?
Yeah, there used to be a big dichotomy. The screenwriters, film writers were considered to be higher level, more prestige than TV writers. But I think these days, I've only written one miniseries myself. I haven't done much TV writing, but I think the television these days, I mean, things like Mad Men and so forth, they're just amazing. So I think some of that stigma is disappearing, and that writers should be able to do both. It's still unlikely, though. Usually you're a film writer or you're a TV writer, and not too many writers do both.
Would you, should aspiring screenwriters take classes or go to university? What?
Right. Well, I think for me, it was reading screenplays. It was reading screenplays and learning the format and learning how scenes fell together. That inspired me and helped me learn to write. I think it just varies from person to person. I think the one thing people can do is be in a group of writers who read one another's work. If that means a classroom, or if that means a group that meets every Friday night around the kitchen table, I think it's really valuable to read your work aloud to other people and have them comment on it. So whatever venue you can do that in, that's great.
Hmm. What are your current projects?
I just had a script optioned. It's the details are being worked out right now. It's called Hemingway in Paris, and it's set in 1920s Paris. It's Hemingway as he was writing A Sun Also Rises and kind of moving from wife one to wife two.
So, I mean, I've recently read, and we previewed on the show, The Paris Wife. Does it have a lot of overlap with that?
I hope not. The Paris Wife is something I would never read, because having written a script in the same genre, I would not want to be influenced by that book. Mm-hmm. I understand, however, that that book is told from Hadley's point of view.
Correct.
And mine is told from Hemingway's point of view. And it involves both Hadley and, you know, Pauline, the second wife. But it's very much Hemingway's story, not her story, even though she's certainly a character. But it's one of those things. I wrote a script on Edna St. Vincent Millay, too, and a biographer wrote something about her. And I've never been able to read the biography, because if somebody makes my film, I can't be touched by somebody else's point of view. I have to keep to my own. And the irony is, of course, I'd love to be able to read these other people's books because the subject interests me so much, but, you know, I really can't. So The Paris Wife, unfortunately, I don't know anything about it other than it's from Hadley's point of view.
I know that a lot of authors, when they're researching a subject or a place, they actually have to go and live there for a while and soak up the details. Is it the same for a screenwriter?
Absolutely. Place is everything, especially when you're doing period pieces or historical pieces. You need to go where that person lived. You need to walk where they walked. You need to have the audacity to put yourself in their shoes and imagine what their life was like. And you can sit behind your laptop and imagine what Paris was like in the 20s. Or you can go to Paris and see the cafes they lived in and imagine Hemingway sitting over in that corner. You know, I mean, it's really, really different to sit and imagine. I have a great imagination, but it becomes an uber imagination when I get to Paris and am able to put what I know about Hemingway into that cafe. So the script becomes better. You must go where these people actually lived.
Do screenwriters do extensive outlining like authors do, or mostly you do the research and then do the writing?
Every writer is different. Most writers do extensive outlining. I am not one of them. I don't even like outlines. However, most studios require them. I've often told my agent to just, you know, forego the outline, for which you'll get, you know, several tens of thousands of dollars to do an outline. I'd rather not have the money. I want to write the script from scratch without having to follow an outline, even an outline I've written. But generally speaking, they want to know what your overall concept is, so they make you do an outline first, and then you do the screenplay. So It's kind of the way the business is.
So it's important to have the kernel of the idea before you actually flush out the 200 pages.
Oh, yeah, sure. 100, no, never 200. 100, 110, oh. Generally speaking. Or so is what is. It's about a minute of screen time is equal to one typed page of the screenplay. So 120-page screenplay is 2 hours. Mm. And you don't see many two-hour movies anymore. They're usually more like an hour and a half or a little bit more. So 100, 110 pages is what to aim for.
Mm. Well, Diane, thanks for taking time from your very busy schedule to speak with us. Thanks.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for asking.
Report doesn't usually delve into how-tos, but story, substance, structure, style, and the principles of screenwriting is such a classic and so highly recommended, we're going to include it. Robert McKee's screenwriting workshops have earned him an international reputation for inspiring novices, refining works in progress, and putting major screenwriting careers back on track. Quincy Jones, Diane Keaton, Gloria Steinem, Julia Roberts, and David Bowie are just a few of his celebrity alumni. Writers, producers, execs, and agents all flock to his lecture series for an intense learning experience. In Story, McKee expands on the concepts he teaches in his seminars, providing listeners with the most comprehensive, integrated explanation of the craft of writing for the screen, how the elements of a screenplay fit together, the magic of story construction, and the relationship between structure and character. The author narrates.
Imagine, in one global day, the pages of prose turned, plays performed, films screened, the unending stream of television, comedy, and drama, 24-hour print and broadcast news, bedtime tales told to children, barroom bragging, internet backfence gossip, mankind's insatiable appetite for stories. We tell and take in stories as much as we sleep, and even then we dream. Why is so much of our life spent inside stories? Because stories are equipment for living. Our appetite for story is a reflection of the profound human need to grasp the patterns of life, not merely as an intellectual exercise, but within a very personal, emotional experience. In the words of playwright Jean Ennui, fiction gives life its form. Yet, while the ever-expanding reach of the media now gives us the opportunity to send stories beyond borders and languages to hundreds of millions, the overall quality of storytelling is eroding. Each year, Hollywood produces and or distributes 400 to 500 films, virtually a film a day. Few are excellent, but the majority are mediocre or worse. Hollywood cannot find better material than it produces. The hard-to-believe truth is that what we see on the screen each year is a reasonable reflection of the best writing of the last couple years. Why? For many reasons, but this above all. Today's would-be writers rush to the typewriter without first learning their craft. If your dream were to compose music, would you say to yourself, I've heard a lot of symphonies, I can also play the piano. I think I'll knock one out this weekend. Of course not. You'd head for music school to study both theory and practice, focusing on the genre of symphony. After years of diligence, you'd merge your knowledge with your creativity, flex your courage, and venture to the keyboard. But that's exactly how many novice writers begin. I've seen a lot of flicks, good and bad. I got A's in English. Vacation time's coming. So they plunge in, counting solely on experience, thinking that the life they've lived and the films they've seen give them something to say and a way to say it. What they mistake for technique is simply the unconscious absorption of story elements from every novel, film, or play they've ever encountered. But unconsciously ingrained perceptions are not, in any sense, technique, and lead to screenplays clogged with clichés of the commercial or art house variety. In short, they lack a writer's education. Early in the first half of this century, teachers of creative writing, such as William Archer, Kenneth Rowe, and John Howard Lawson, taught an intrinsic understanding of story, drawing strength from the big muscle movements of desire, forces of antagonism, turning points, spine, progression, crisis, climax. Stories seen from the inside out. Over the last 25 years, however, the method of teaching creative writing in American universities has reversed from the intrinsic to the extrinsic. Trends in literary theory have drawn professors away from the deep sources of story toward language, codes, social context, stories seen from the outside. As a result, the young writer leaves the university with a sophisticated knowledge of his professional role in society, but an unfortunate ignorance of the craft needed to carry it out.
Succinct yet comprehensive, A Short History of Film provides a riveting overview of the major movements, directors, studios, and genres from the 1880s to the present. Authors Wheeler Winston Dixon and Gwendolyn Audrey Foster lead a fast-paced tour through the invention of the kinetoscope, the introduction of sound and color between the two world wars, and today's computer-generated imagery. They detail significant periods in world cinema, including the early major industries in Europe, the dominance of the Hollywood studio system in the 30s and 40s, and the French New Wave of the 1960s. Movie lovers will be fascinated by segments on censorship, independent efforts in developing countries, and the indie movement in the U.S. The title is narrated by Walter Dixon.
Audemars Anschutz created the electrical tachyscope, which used a flickering light to illuminate a series of still photographs placed along the circumference of a rotating disc, much like the zoetrope. He later developed this device into the projecting electrotachyscope, which projected these moving images on a screen. Phantom trains were also popular during this period, in which passengers would travel the world through the illusion of projected backdrops, while primitive hydraulic devices created the sensation of movement, much like today's amusement rides at Universal Studios and Disneyland. As a sort of precursor to the big-budget cinema spectacles of the 1950s, Robert Barker's Panorama, which played in Edinburgh in 1787, presented to audiences views of huge paintings that recreated famous historical tableaux. Such early magic lantern devices as the chromatrope, ideotrope, and Peter van Musenbroek's magic lantern used mechanical apparatus to shift the images in front of the audience's eyes, creating the illusion of movement. Yet all these early gestures toward what would become the motion picture remained merely tantalizing hints of what might be accomplished until the late 19th century, when a series of inventions by a number of technicians and artists throughout the world brought the idea of moving pictures to primitive fruition. Perhaps the most famous progenitor of the cinema was Eadweard Muybridge, who created motion studies of cats, birds, horses, and the human figure in 1872, using a series of up to 40 still cameras whose shutters were released by tripwires, activated by Muybridge's subjects. The first movies. Working in Palo Alto, California, Muybridge's most celebrated experiment took place near the beginning of his career, when he was hired by Leland Stanford, then governor of California, to settle a bet as to whether or not a horse had all four legs in the air during a race, or relied upon one leg on the ground at all times to keep balanced. In 1878, Muybridge used his tripwire technique to produce a series of images of a galloping horse at a Palo Alto racetrack, decisively demonstrating that a horse did indeed have all four legs off the ground when running at a fast clip. By 1879, Muybridge was using his zoopraxiscope to project these brief segments of motion onto a screen for audiences. The average clip ran only a few seconds. This is the beginning of projected motion pictures, arising from a series of stills taken by a number of different cameras, run together rapidly to create the illusion of motion. Another cinematic pioneer, Étienne Jules Marais, invented what might be considered the first truly portable moving picture camera in 1882, a machine gun-styled affair that photographed 12 plates in rapid succession on one disc. In 1888, Marais switched to Eastman paper film instead of glass plates and was able to record 40 images in one burst, using only one camera. Perhaps the most mysterious figure of the era is Louis-Aimé Augustin Leprince, whose experiments in cinematography were revolutionary and remain controversial to this day. In Paris, in 1887, Leprince built a 16-lens camera, capable of photographing 16 images in rapid succession of a single scene. By March or April of 1888, working in Leeds, England, Leprince successfully created a single-lens camera that used a series of photographic plates to record motion, later replacing the plates with perforated paper film from the George Eastman Company, as Marais had, for greater ease of projection. In October 1888, Leprince photographed his brother, Adolphe, playing the melodeon, a primitive accordion, in the garden behind his laboratory. In the same month, he photographed members of his family in the same garden at Oakwood Grange, strolling through the grass.
Joe Esterhaus spent his earliest years in post-World War II refugee camps. He came to America and grew up in Cleveland, stealing cars, rolling drunks, battling priests, nearly going to jail. He became the screenwriter of hits that included Basic Instinct, Jagged Edge, and Flashdance. He also wrote the legendary disastrous Showgirls and Jade. The rebellion never ended, even as his films went on to gross more than $1 billion at the box office, and he became the most famous or infamous screenwriter in Hollywood. Controversial, fearless, extremely talented, and totally unpredictable. On one level, Hollywood Animal is a shocking look at the inside of the movie business. Esterhaus reveals the fights, the deals, the extortions, the backstabbing, and the sex, drugs, and rock and roll world that is Hollywood. But there's more to this book. It's the story of a street kid who survives a life filled with obstacles and pain, love affairs, illness, and betrayals. Scott Brick narrates.
He made it through the chaos of the combat lines 2 weeks after I was born. The Red Army was sweeping through Hungary. American bombs fell hourly from the sky. During one bombing, as my mother raced down the stairs with me in her arms, the roof collapsed onto the stairway. I was knocked from her arms as she and my father were propelled down the stairs. When it was over, desperate, they searched for me and couldn't find me. They thought I had been covered by the rubble. They finally found me. An old woman had picked me up. She had taken her babushka and covered my mouth with it. She had saved my life. The apartment house had taken a direct hit. My parents lost everything but one suitcase. The suitcase was filled with cartons of cigarettes, to be used as currency in this ravaged new world. My father decided after that bombing that we had to leave Hungary. He drove us in his small car from Szombathely toward the Austrian border. Refugees and retreating Nazis and Hungarian soldiers were everywhere. American fighter pilots buzzed the treetops and machine-gunned the cars below. They machine-gunned us, but my father roared over a ditch and into the trees. We crossed the Austrian border and were incarcerated by the Nazis. The Nazis took us to a camp called Mauthausen. It was a Shido extermination camp, filled with Jews from all over Europe. The Nazis put us on the same diet as the Jews, nothing but pine needle soup. A German soldier gave my mother a sliced-in-half gasoline can so she could bathe me. We were at Mauthausen for 2 months. One morning, the Germans were gone. The war was over. We were free. That's what my father told me, and I, of course, believed him. The British and the Americans came. We stayed in one refugee camp for a while, and then we moved to another, all in Austria. We lived in barracks. There wasn't any food for months, except polenta, which we called puliska. I cried all the time. I cried when I had to eat puliska. I cried whenever I saw a soldier. I cried whenever I heard a siren. And I heard sirens often in the camps because fires in the barracks were common. One night, the sirens sounded and people were screaming, running out of the barracks. I ran outside too, holding on to my mother. They pulled a body out of the outhouse, the body of a little boy. He smelled. He was covered in shit and was dead. He had fallen through the hole into the shit and drowned there. It is my first memory. I see his body and it smells, and my mother is holding me, and I am crying.
Hollywood movie making is one of the constants of American life. In The Way Hollywood Tells It, Story and Style in Modern Movies, author David Bordwell traces the principles of this visual storytelling. Bordwell shines the spotlight on a wide array of films made since the 1960s, from romantic comedies like Jerry Maguire and Love Actually to more imposing efforts like A Beautiful Mind. He also draws upon testimony from writers, directors, and editors on proven principles of plot and visual style. He examines how imaginative filmmakers have set new standards in films such as JFK, Memento, and Magnolia. The book ranges across four decades, examining classics like American Graffiti and The Godfather, as well as more recent successes like The Lord of the Rings. The book provides a vivid and engaging interpretation of how Hollywood movie makers have created a vigorous, resourceful tradition of cinematic storytelling. Critic Roger Ebert called Bordwell one of the best writers in cinema today. He said, "He is deeply informed about films. He loves them, and he writes about them with a clarity and perception that makes the prose a joy to read. By showing, often in shot-by-shot detail, how the films communicate through style as much as subject and story, his book is liberating, allowing us to see precisely what films are doing and why. I find David Bordwell's book to be simply astonishing," unquote. Let's listen as Lloyd James narrates.
Feature filmmaking continued to hemorrhage money. By some estimates, as much as $500 million between 1969 and 1972. Yet by 1980, the industry was earning stupendous profits. What changed? For one thing, a tax scheme sponsored by the Nixon administration allowed the producers to write off hundreds of millions of dollars in past and future investments. The studios also found ways to integrate their business more firmly with broadcast television, cable, the record industry, and home video. Just as important, a new generation of filmmakers emerged. Some, modeling their work on the more personal European cinema they admired, produced Americanized art films like Five Easy Pieces, 1970, and Mean Streets, 1973. The young directors who found the biggest success, however, were willing to work in established genres for a broad audience. They were responsible for a burst of record-breaking hits. The French Connection, 1971, The Godfather, 1972, The Exorcist, 1973, American Graffiti, 1973, Jaws, 1975, Saturday Night Fever, 1977, Star Wars, 1977, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1977. There were less innovative top grossers as well, such as Fiddler on the Roof, 1971, and The Sting, 1973. In all, the 1970s lifted the ceiling on what a film could earn, and it remains the decade with the most top grossers in adjusted dollars. On its U.S. release, Jaws reaped about $260 million, the equivalent of $940 million today. Star Wars took in over $307 million on its initial domestic release, a staggering $990 million in 2005 dollars. And after re-releases, it became by far the top-earning film of the modern era. No films had ever made so much money so quickly. The studio's decision-makers realized that the market for a movie was much bigger than anyone had suspected, and they settled on a business strategy to exploit the mega picture, or blockbuster. This was a must-see movie, very different from the roadshow attraction. Budgeted at the highest level, launched in the summer or the Christmas season, playing off a best-selling book or a pop culture fad like disco, advertised endlessly on television and then opening in hundreds, eventually thousands, of theaters on the same weekend, the blockbuster was calculated to sell tickets fast. By the early 1980s, merchandising was added to the mix. So tie-ins with fast food chains, automobile companies, and lines of toys and apparel could keep selling the movie. Scripts that lent themselves to mass marketing had a better chance of being acquired, and screenwriters were encouraged to incorporate special effects. Unlike studio-era productions, the mega picture could lead a robust afterlife on a soundtrack album, on cable channels, and on video cassette. By the mid-1980s, once overseas income and ancillaries were reckoned in, few films lost money.
Much has been written about Hollywood of the 70s, but while Scorsese, Spielberg, and Coppola were making their first classic movies, a parallel universe of directors gave birth to the modern horror film, aggressive, raw, and utterly original. Based on unprecedented access to the genre's major players, New York Times critic Jacek Zinnemann's Shock Value delivers the first definitive account of horror's golden age. By the late 1960s, horror was stuck in the past, confined mostly to drive-in theaters and shunned by critics. Shock Value tells the unlikely story of how the much-disparaged horror film conquered the multiplex. Directors Wes Craven, Roman Polanski, John Carpenter, and Brian De Palma, counterculture types operating largely outside of Hollywood, revolutionized the genre, exploding taboos, and bringing a confrontational style. It was horror with a political edge. Zinnemann recounts how these directors produced such classics as Rosemary's Baby, Carrie, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Halloween, and in doing so, created a template for horror that has been imitated relentlessly, but whose originality has rarely been matched. This new kind of film dispensed with the old vampires and instead assaulted audiences with serial killers, the darkest side of suburbia, and a brand of violence never before seen. Shock Value tells the improbable stories behind the making of these movies, often directed by obsessive and insecure young men working on shoestring budgets, funded by sketchy investors, and sometimes even featuring porn stars. But once The Exorcist became the highest-grossing film in America, Hollywood took notice, and the rest is cinematic history. Pete Larkin narrates.
Cunningham struck out into movies when there were not many independent feature companies operating out of New York. He was a natural showman, and his great insight as a promoter was in his advertisements, subverting the usual puffery, scariest film of all time, that no one believed anymore. Instead, he told the audience to stay away, for their own good. Not recommended for persons over 30, the poster for The Last House on the Left warned. For those brave enough to attend, the ad urged, just keep telling yourself, it's only a movie, it's only a movie. Craven, however, was not interested in offering such comfort. To him, the point was to make the horrific violence look so real that you might entertain the thought that maybe this isn't just a movie. Wes Craven was serious. He wasn't the only one. On the West Coast, around the same time, another few aspiring filmmakers were watching a maniacal-looking man with scraggly hair wield a knife over a young girl. Dan O'Bannon, the actor playing the sweaty brute with an authentic-sounding southern accent, appeared at first in shadow, a dark shape walking down a hill. The director cut to a virginal babysitter sitting in the living room by herself. When she answered the phone, she hears only heavy breathing. Silence. The phone rings again, more breathing. "Is this one of your jokes?" she says, the television blaring in the background. Suddenly, the perspective shifts to a shaky camera shot outside the suburban house where the potential victim appears through the window. The phone rings again, but it's the operator this time. "The killer's inside the house!" The lulling tone shifts into hectic cuts and a synthesizer soundtrack as a silent madman races after the victim, ending in police gunfire and death. The story of the killer stalking the babysitter from inside the house was an old urban legend, but it had yet to become a movie trope. Screened at the USC Film School, the 15-minute short, Foster's Release, was later shown at the Edinburgh Film Festival and largely forgotten. Its director, Terence Winkless, a soft-spoken student with experience acting on television, didn't care much about horror. He saw it as a lark, and the thought of expanding this movie into a feature did not occur to him. When Winkless moved on to create something closer to his heart, Wallflower, a soulful meditation about the challenges of being an artist, he received written criticism from his classmates, mostly anonymous, except for one pointed assessment. "I don't know anything from the ending. Nothing happens one way or the other," it stated brusquely. "Cutting was at times very effective, but you kept coming back to that side medium shot." The critic signed his name J.H.C., the initials for John Howard Carpenter. John Carpenter would go on to direct his own heavy-breathing stalker babysitter movie less than a decade later. Halloween became one of the most commercially successful and artistically influential horror movies ever made. Winkless worked on a few films, including co-writing The Howling, but his career never took off. The way he describes it, Foster's Release could be considered the Rosetta Stone of modern horror.
Okay, since we've wandered into the horror genre, we've got to give a nod to Stephen King. Let's look at a classic, The Shining. When you check the reader reviews, you see that the vast majority of folks say the book is so much more than the movie, even with Jack Nicholson's stellar performance. For all its suspense and genuinely frightening passages, Stephen King's classic novel remains a shattering look at how alcoholism destroys a family. If you believe you know this novel only from watching Stanley Kubrick's film, it's time to listen and be surprised by the differences. First published in 1977, The Shining became a benchmark in King's literary career. It's the tale of a troubled man hired to care for a remote mountain resort over the winter, his loyal wife, and their uniquely gifted son. The story steadily unfolds as secrets from the Overlook Hotel's past are revealed, and the hotel itself attempts to claim the very souls of the Torrance family. The Shining stands as a cultural icon of modern horror, a searing study of a family torn apart and a nightmarish glimpse into the dark recesses of human weakness and dementia. Campbell Scott narrates.
He brought back 5 large sheets and set them down on the glossy walnut plane of the desk. Jack stood by his shoulder, very much aware of the scent of Ullman's cologne. "All my men wear English leather or they wear nothing at all," came into his mind for no reason at all, and he had to clamp his tongue between his teeth to keep in a bray of laughter. Beyond the wall, faintly, came the sounds of the Overlook Hotel's kitchen, gearing down from lunch. "Top floor," Ullman said briskly. "The attic. Absolutely nothing up there now but bric-a-brac. The Overlook has changed hands several times since World War II, and it seems that each successive manager has put everything they don't want up in the attic. I want rat traps and poison bait sewed around in it. Some of the third-floor chambermaids say they have heard rustling noises. I don't believe it, not for a moment, but there mustn't even be that 1 in 100 chance that a single rat inhabits the Overlook Hotel." Jack, who suspected that every hotel in the world had a rat or two, held his tongue. "Of course, you wouldn't allow your son up in the attic under any circumstances." "No," Jack said, and flashed the big PR smile again. "Humiliating situation. Did this officious little prick actually think he would allow his son to goof around in a rat-trap attic full of junk furniture and God knew what else? Ullman whisked away the attic floor plan and put it on the bottom of the pile. The Overlook has 110 guest quarters, he said in a scholarly voice. 30 of them, all suites, are here on the third floor. 10 in the west wing, including the presidential suite. 10 in the center, 10 more in the east wing. All of them command magnificent views. Could you at least spare the sales talk? But he kept quiet. He needed the job. Ullman put the third floor on the bottom of the pile, and they studied the second floor. 40 rooms, Ullman said. 30 doubles and 10 singles, and on the first floor, 20 of each. Plus 3 linen closets on each floor, and a storeroom which is at the extreme east end of the hotel on the second floor, and the extreme west end on the first. Questions? Jack shook his head. Ullman whisked the second and first floors away. Now, lobby level. Here in the center is the registration desk. Behind it are the offices. The lobby runs for 80 feet in either direction from the desk. Over here in the west wing is the Overlook dining room and the Colorado lounge. The banquet and ballroom facility is in the east wing. Questions? Only about the basement, Jack said. For the winter caretaker, that's the most important level of all. Where the action is, so to speak. Watson will show you all that. The basement floor plan is on the boiler room wall. He frowned impressively, perhaps to show that as manager, he did not concern himself with such mundane aspects of the Overlook's operation as the boiler and the plumbing. Might not be a bad idea to put some traps down there, too. Just a minute. He scrawled a note on a pad he took from his inner coat pocket. Each sheet bore the legend, "From the desk of Stuart Ullman," in bold black script, tore it off, and dropped it into the outbasket. It sat there looking lonesome. The pad disappeared back into Ullman's jacket pocket like the conclusion of a magician's trick. Now you see it, Jackie boy, now you don't. This guy is a real heavyweight. They had resumed their original positions, Ullman behind the desk and Jack in front of it, interviewer and interviewee, supplicant and reluctant patron. Ullman folded his neat little hands on the desk blotter and looked directly at Jack, a small, balding man in a banker's suit and a quiet gray tie. The flower in his lapel was balanced off by a small lapel pin on the other side. It read simply, "Staff," in small gold letters. I'll be perfectly frank with you, Mr. Torrance. Albert Shockley is a powerful man with a large interest in the Overlook, which showed a profit this season for the first time in its history. Mr. Shockley also sits on the board of directors, but he is not a hotel man, and he would be the first to admit this. But he has made his wishes in this caretaking matter quite obvious. He wants you hired. I will do so. But if I had been given a free hand in this matter, I would not have taken you on. Jack's hands were clenched tightly in his lap, working against each other, sweating. Officious little... I don't believe you care much for me, Mr. Torrance. I don't care. Certainly your feelings toward me play no part in my own belief that you are not right for the job. During the season that runs from May 15th to September 30th, the Overlook employs 110 people full-time. One for every room in the hotel, you might say.
And now, a landmark study of a man whose work touched us all, but whose life was shrouded in myth. Author Neil Gabler in Walt Disney, The Triumph of American Imagination, spent 7 years researching and writing, and was the first writer to be given complete access to the Disney archives. Gabler shows us the young Disney, breaking free of a childhood of discipline and deprivation, and making his way to Hollywood. We see the visionary man, who had an innate sense of what people wanted to see on the screen. It was Disney, first with Mickey Mouse and then with his feature films, who transformed animation from a novelty based on movement to an art form that presented an illusion of life. The author also reveals a wounded, lonely, and often disappointed man who, despite worldwide success, was plagued with financial problems, suffered a nervous breakdown, and at times retreated into seclusion in his workshop, making model trains. Gabler explores accusations that Disney was a red-baiter, an anti-Semite, and an embittered alcoholic. Yet whatever his personal failings, this is a book about a man we all loved. It's read by Arthur Morey.
The Saturday Evening Post once called him the world's most celebrated entertainer and possibly its best-known non-political public figure. And the New York Times eulogized him as probably the only man to have been praised by both the American Legion and the Soviet Union. But Walt Disney's influence cannot be measured by numbers or encomia. It can only be measured by how thoroughly he reshaped the culture and the American consciousness. Disney was protean. In the late 1920s, he began reinventing animation, gradually turning it from a novelty that emphasized movement and elasticity of line into an art form that emphasized character, narrative, and emotion. In doing so, he also helped reinvent graphic design by introducing the soft, round, bold, colorful forms that decades later would be adopted and adapted by a vanguard of fine artists. The critic Robert Hughes credited him with inventing pop art itself, not only in the look he bequeathed, but also in the convergence of high art and low that he affected. "It happened," Hughes wrote, "when in Fantasia, Mickey Mouse clambered up to the real podium and shook hands with the real conductor, Leopold Stokowski." Beyond his animations, Disney changed the shape of American recreation with his Disneyland Park. Obviously, there had been amusement parks before Disneyland, but they had been grab bag collections of various rides, games, and shows. Disney reconceptualized the amusement park as a full imaginative experience, a theme park, rather than a series of diversions. And just as his animation revised graphic design, his park eventually revised urban design. Detractors called the effect Disneyfication, meaning the substitution of a synthetic world for a real one. But the urban planner James W. Rouse commended Disneyland as the greatest piece of urban design in the United States for the way it managed to serve its function and satisfy its guests. And architecture critic Peter Blake wrote, "It seems unlikely that any American school of architecture will ever again graduate a student without first requiring him to take a field trip to Orlando, Florida, the site of Walt Disney World Resort, the East Coast sequel to Disneyland." In time, Disneyland, with its faux environments and manipulated experiences, would become a metaphor for a whole new consciousness in which, for better or worse, the fabricated was preferred over the authentic, and the real could be purged of its threats. As Robert Hughes put it, his achievement became a large shift in the limits of unreality. Disney's influence also impregnated the American mind in subtler, less widely recognized ways. As he reinvented animation and amusement, he changed Americans' view of their own history and values. In live-action films like So Dear to My Heart, Old Yeller, and Pollyanna, he refined and exploited a load of nostalgia that became identifiable enough to be called Disney-esque. And in others like Davy Crockett, Westward Ho the Wagons, and Johnny Tremaine, he fashioned an American past of rugged heroes and bold accomplishment that for generations turned history into boyhood adventure. By the end of his life, it was the saccharine values of the nostalgic films and the sturdy patriotism of the historical ones, as much as the cartoons that one associated with Disney, and that made him, along with Norman Rockwell, the leading avatar of small-town, flag-waving America. At the same time, however, his forward-looking television programs depicting the future helped shape attitudes about technological change, and NASA acknowledged that Disney's early drumbeating for its program was instrumental in generating public support for space exploration. It was Disney, too, who created Tomorrowland at his Disneyland theme park and collaborated with Monsanto on a House of the Future attraction there, and Disney who advanced the ideas of monorails, people movers, audio animatronic robots, and other marvels, even to the point of designing an entire city that would, had it been built, have incorporated the latest in technology and urban planning. ¶¶
Everyone loves the movies, and I know I've enjoyed this different look at Hollywood and its movers and shakers. I'm off to see The Help this weekend, a book we previewed this past January. To hear that audio sample, go to my website, bookreportradio.com, and click on Archived Shows for January 1st. And while you're there, see which other books you might like to pick up. Thanks so much for joining me, and see you next week on The Book Report.